Hello there and welcome to the sixth episode of Observable Stream. And today we're going to be talking about graph data stores and graph data processing systems in our new series, Novel Data Stores. And we wanted to kick off this talk about graph databases, graph theory, graph data processing systems with a little bit of an introduction into what actually is graph theory, why is it interesting, why is it actually an interesting concept, both visually and also theoretically in terms of mathematics. And for that, I'm here with my esteemed colleague, Reagan.
Hey, Phil.
And Reagan is going to talk us through a little bit of the introduction around graph theory. Take it away.
So graph theory fundamentally is the study of entities and their relationships. So some of our listeners might have heard of the term graph before, but they might be thinking about charts or histograms that they might have encountered in applications like Excel or even just drawing these up in school. But here, graph is actually referring to a different situation where you have what we call nodes, and they're sort of just little entities, and you can connect these to one another. And that can have a different significance based on what problem you're looking at. So we typically call these nodes and edges. And surprisingly, many different problems that you wouldn't expect to be related, eventually condense down into problems in graph theory. Some applications in graph theory include problems in geometry. So being a very spatial subfield of mathematics, they map very closely to problems in space. So for one problem that is very close to our hearts working at Picnic is how to find optimal routes in neighborhoods and between warehouses to save on transport costs and on distribution costs. And this turns out to be a very classical graph theory problem. Another problem in sort of memory managed languages, you typically have a garbage collection system, and typically a reference graph or a reference network is maintained to check what pieces of memory are still used. And there are iterative algorithms that are applied to these graphs that allow you to determine whether any part of your program is still utilizing that memory. But there are many, many, many applications of graph theory, and I'm sure we're going to get into many of them in this episode. So, Phil, do you have any other thoughts on sort of the fundamentals of graph theory?
When I started computer science, I had to dig around for a while to find out why didn't we just call these networks, because there's a much more intuitive, translatable name for graphs. You also have the concept of networks in computer science, and, you have artificial neural networks. We don't call them artificial neural graphs. You have networks, as in networks where we send traffic over the internet, or phone mobile networks where you send traffic via satellites to mobile devices. You have all sorts of networks. Graph theory is indeed the theoretic study of networks, how they interact, how we classify as well different types of networks. So there are also mathematical classes of graphs and therefore of networks. You have, for example, the very simple example are a directed graph versus an undirected graph. So that is where you have a network or a graph where the nodes or the vertices have a directional edge between the two. So say node A and node B, or vertex A and vertex B, has a directional edge between the two. So that's to say I am related to you, but you aren't related to me. As one example, or data flows from this node to this node, but not the other way around. Those are just two very simple classes of graphs. Those are kind of like the highest level of abstraction. Then you go boiled further down and further down, where you have things such as multigraphs, where there can be multiple edges between the same two nodes. You also have a way to classify graphs in terms of their in terms of their computational properties. So for example, a chordal graph, you also have then the properties of a graph, whether it can be colored, and we'll get onto that in a little later, but then we're getting into the computational area of graph theory, where we're looking at the algorithms and we're saying, let's take the routing example. Is there anyway a route between A and B? Is that even possible in a directed graph? And if there is, then which is the most optimal in terms of, the distance between every node? what is the fastest way I can get from node A to node B across a huge graph? And that's then just, like you mentioned, a very typical example in logistics and in distribution, where you want to, or in any way, when you load up Google Maps and you want to travel from location A to location B, well, Google will sometimes tell you, actually, this isn't even possible, this route, that you want to cross the ocean in your car. So you need to factor in a ferry travel, or you need to, maybe there's no ferry, you need to get a plane from A to B. So that's a very simple algorithm, I guess, that where you need to say whether or not this graph is actually entirely connected. So can you get from every node to every other node? If it's not, then you have what's called a forest, which is a set of graphs in a same space, in the same space. And then after that, then you run your route optimization algorithm. So a B-star algorithm is a typical class of routing algorithms. A very famous one of those is called Dijkstra's algorithm, which is the most efficient in terms of runtime notation, big O notation. And yeah, then those are just some examples of why you would even consider using graphs. Maybe to take it one step back and to think about more of the other applications of graph theory in a modern sense, I think one of those is the idea of a graph database. So, okay, you have graphs, you have a graph theory, you want to prove things about the graph, but you also want to store and you want to evolve your graphs over time as well. So you actually want it to be, you want to basically host your graph database as a service for a application or for a piece of software that is talking to that graph database. So maybe Regan, you can talk a little bit about, introduce a little bit the space of graph databases.
Of course. I first want to make a comment on what you're saying there about directed graphs and undirected graphs. So in the case of sort of the supply chain situation, having a directed graph would imply that you have maybe like a higher speed railway to one location, but not necessarily one coming back. Mm-hmm. So you're sort of picking the abstraction level that suits your problem space. And I think you mentioned that also that these connections, the edges, as we call them, they can also have costs associated with them. So some paths within a graph might be more favorable than others, depending on what cost metric you're establishing. In the logistics space, you're typically talking about sort of fuel costs, and you're talking about vehicle utilization. So you're trying to optimize those cost metrics, but you could choose any number depending on what your problem space is. Mm-hmm. In terms of the...
That's interesting you say that, because often the very basic theoretical examples are never enough really for most practical applications of a theory of, or like a, let's say a class of structures or data structures like a graph, which leads into this idea of a property graph or a label property graph. This is where we can start to make actually useful analysis or useful sense or make real use of a graph in data form, right? Where you actually have not just A and B are connected, but A and B connected with this property of this relationship, and A and B also have lots more properties about their node. That's when you can start to use it as a real data structure, right?
Mm, definitely. And there are many ways that you can store graphs. So a naive approach, if you're a programmer yourself and you've maybe written a binary tree, you might think, oh, we're going to write an object, a node object, and it's going to have children of n number of nodes. Mm-hmm. But it turns out a very convenient way to store graphs is in what we call an adjacency matrix. Mm-hmm. So if you have a social network and you're trying to keep track of who's friends with who, one way you can do that is to tabulate it, where you have all of your users as rows and all of your users as columns. And if it so happens that they are connected in some way, maybe they're friends, mm-hmm. or yeah, if they're connected in some meaningful manner, you can have a check mark wherever that occurs. So you have sort of this table where all of these relationships occur. And that is actually very convenient for performing computations on graphs. Mm-hmm. And that's actually, people would never say this, but one of the most popular graph processing systems is TensorFlow, the used for machine learning, because these tensors are actually just at the core of them, they can be interpreted as graphs, and you're calculating the weights and the outputs of running inputs through a neural network.
Yeah, absolutely.
An interpretation of that is just in matrices rather than in these visual graphs.
Yeah, exactly. Like at the very basic level, you have a vector. Then you have more complex. You have a matrix. Then you have multi-dimensional matrices. But they're all representable as graphs, right? And graphs are really just almost like a simplification or reduction of matrices and linear algebra, right? Like if you have linear algebra problems, you want to transpose matrices, you want to multiply matrices, you want to handle matrices to extract some meaningful information out of them. And graphs are just like a reduction of that problem, and the adjacency list is exactly like the one of the most common ways to store graph data. Another one is edge lists, but they're less efficient in certain circumstances, and we can get onto this in a little bit. But there you just store like a log or a list of all of the edges in your graph. So every new line is just simply this edge represents a connection between these two nodes. Whereas an adjacency list is different, because there you're saying like A is adjacent to B and C and D, and that's a single line. They're very much like single node oriented. So there's only the number of lines as there are nodes in the graph. Whereas if for an edge list, there is the number of lines that you have in your file will be the number of edges in your graph. And you can obviously see where the limitations and where the storage benefits the compression, or how you even use the data changes by how you orient the storage, which is a very important concept for like graph databases for sure.
And this is actually a point of concern with like these very big physics simulations. So you can use graph theory to simulate certain types of like dynamic fluid flow in sort of aerospace and aerodynamics. And the way that you would, there's obviously computational limits to how many nodes you can process on a single CPU, but splitting up a simulation onto many physical or maybe even in logical CPUs, that turns out to be a hard problem. So interpreting this through a linear algebra sense helps you make the partitions where you can actually simulate isolated parts of your graph. That's where the idea of sort of what we call strongly connected components becomes important. So where are the neighborhoods in your graph? Like where are the nodes that are really clustered together? And this has applications in things like compiler design, where if you model each of your variables in scope as a node, and their connections being that they occur, well, the nodes being variables and whether they occur in the same scope being their connections, you can then use graph theory to more accurately predict which variables should be allocated in registers at the same time, which conflicts do we have, where do we not have variables occurring in the same place, so that we can more optimally move things in and out of like level one caches and into registers. So there's very interesting, even very low level hardware applications for graph theory. But from the sort of database perspective, we mentioned the adjacency matrix. So normal SQL databases are an option for simulating graphs, but obviously bespoke custom graph databases have been engineered for running these more effectively. And so there's a few, you mentioned Neo4j, and that I would say that that's like the predominant sort of industrial grade graph database. I think it originally came out of the Java space, but I think Phil, you're probably more clued up with the history there. But to name some other graph systems, there's also Janus Graph, there's TypeDB, ArangoDB, and we might contrast those later, but would you be able to sort of speak about the history of graph databases?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So first I want to talk about something that you just said, but I'm going to segue onto this. Do remind me to make sure that I come back to this, because this is the core of the podcast. So my real love for, and this is a shameless plug about my own history, which if you want to go off and get a coffee and skip forward to maybe 5 minutes, then you can. But this is what makes me so excited about graph theory in general. What you mentioned before on how do you partition graphs in a optimal way such that they are conducive or better suited for distributed graph computation frameworks is like what I did my master's degree thesis on. And it all starts with the adjacency matrix that you're talking about. So actually, what makes computing or running graph algorithms over large graph data sets, and we're talking about, you know, hundreds of gigabytes, terabytes of graphs, so like social networks, protein interaction graphs, not just a small company who has 1,000 users and seeing how they interact, but like, you know, millions and billions and billions of nodes. How do you split those up in an optimal way? Now, it actually all kind of boils down to how do you classify the type of your graph? So there's a couple of different categories, and one of those is what's called a natural graph. This is a graph that represents like real world data, and the other one is a random graph, and it's sort of grayscale in between those two. So a random graph is essentially a mathematical model developed by Erdos, who's a famous mathematician from Hungary, and he states that a random graph is a graph where you have any two nodes in the graph have a probability that they are interconnected, and that probability is represented as a p-value. So if you have a graph that has a p-value of 1, that means that every node in that graph is connected to each other, because the probability is always 1 that A is connected to B, that A is connected to C, A is connected to B, A is connected to A even. So if you have a p-value of 1/2, then that means that half the nodes are connected to each other, and so on and so forth. So that's a very mathematical linear way of looking at how the probability distribution of nodes, what the probability distribution of the interconnection of nodes is. Now, a natural graph doesn't behave like that. Like, there's no social network where every user is connected to every other user with a probability of 0.5. It's a different, completely different distribution. And it's usually a very long tail, what's called a power law distribution. So there's a very, very small subset of users who are connected to the vast majority of users. And then the rest of the users are connected to the sort of a small portion of those users. So take Twitter, for example. Lady Gaga or Britney Spears or President Trump, ex-President Trump, thank God, has a lot of followers, but there aren't many users like him, or there aren't many users who are so popular. So the distribution is very much a power law. So it's like, you know, a long tail. Why is that interesting? Well, what you mentioned is before communities and detecting components within a graph. Well, it kind of harkens back to your graph algorithms. A lot of them, or a vast majority, can be treated like dynamic programming. So you can actually reduce a graph algorithm into subcomponents, solve the problem at subcomponent level, and then amalgamate that into a global solution. That's very useful for how do you shard a cluster of machines and the data that they operate on. With natural graphs, this works very well. So you need to make nice cuts in your graph such that you can work on a problem at a local level, and therefore at a community level. And then you can amalgamate the solution to the coordinator node, which then brings together all the results from all of the secondary nodes. And then you solve your, let's say, community detection algorithm, or you solve your B-star algorithm problem, or your graph coloring algorithm. So natural graphs lend themselves very well to being cut up, because you just need to identify where are the clusters and then cut them in a nice way, distribute those partitions of that data to those nodes, then run your computation on them. Random graphs behave very poorly on these systems because you can't make a good cut, because there is no there's no inherent clustering. Random graphs is really just a linear probability that it's going to be, the two nodes are going to be connected. So it's a linear probability scale. So what I was working on then was how do you represent the adjacency list in a more efficient way? Well, it turns out adjacency lists are also actually not very efficient, because you have this thing called a CSR, which is a compressed sparse row. So this relies again on sparse matrices. So just like your natural graph, it's sparse. So the likelihood of a connection between any two nodes is low, but some nodes have a lot of connections. They are really easily compressible. So if you can compress that, well, you can actually even optimize CSR. So you can add another optimization layer on top of that and how you store it, which is based on offsets rather than an index. So if you can offset your every matrix cell from the next matrix cell, then you basically have how many more cells to the right are there without a value or without a connection. And then you keep doing this over and over again. You run this entire compression mechanism over your matrix, and then it turns out you can store huge graphs like the Twitter graph, but at a hugely reduced size. Why is that useful? Well, the graph algorithms, you can easily write graph algorithms to run over the compressed representation. So if you have a smaller compressed representation that you can still run algorithms over without needing to uncompress the data, so it's actually a unidirectional compression, then you can optimize your algorithm massively. You also don't need as many machines. You don't need as much coordination in a distributed system sense, which obviously saves hugely on computation costs. And yeah, that's basically where that comes from. So storage mechanism and storage representation is really key. Now that leads, I guess, onto graph databases. sorry for the long intro. So back in the 1960s, you had this CODASIL group, which back then was trying to define this global network database language in 1969 as a sort of an attempt to standardize how you treat networks or how you treat graphs in a data representation form, and how do you query them, how do you store them, all of those topics. In the 80s, this didn't really make huge inroads. Like, there weren't many, even back then, of course, the 1970s, there weren't many commercial applications of technology in general, or modern day technology in computer science in general. But then you had object database systems in the 1980s, which were kind of what you were alluding to, right? Like, you can also represent graphs just using a regular object-oriented programming language. You have an object and it contains references to its children, and also to its parents, or the parents contain references to their children. You can easily represent this as an object and or a series of classes. Then you have RDFs, so the resource descriptor frameworks. So these are, a part of the semantic web movement, where the idea was to categorize or label all of the information on the internet such that it is computer or machine readable. Why is that nice? Well, rather than having these fancy algorithms, these machine learning algorithms that take the content we've produced as humans and tries to label them, instead the humans do the work of labeling the content. So if you put an image of a cat on the internet, you should label it with your RDF as "this is a cat." It also relates to these entities, these objects. Of course, you can see no one's going to, it's going to be very hard to get consumers to pick up this this kind of work. So RDF is really just the database, or not even the database, but the standard for a triple store, which represents basically a subject, a predicate, and an object. Now, this is maybe starting to sound familiar. This sounds a lot like a graph, because it is a subject, one node, the predicate, the relationship, and then object, the other node. It's a little bit of a simplification. So, you know, what is a subject, predicate, object? That is, subject is a who or a what. So let's say Phil. Then predicate is the verb, likes. And then object is the object that you're referring to. So RDFs. So it would be Phil likes RDFs. And you would store that as a triple in your data store. But with just a storage, you need a query language. So then came Sparkle, which is the triple store query language for the RDF, the resource description framework. There you had some of the ones that the graph databases now you're starting to talk about before, which is Gina, which was first actually maintained by HP, or developed by HP and then handed over to Apache, where it still runs now, I think. This was back in the early 2000s when HP started to work on it. Then you have BlazeGraph, which is in the mid-2010s. Then you have Amazon Neptune, which is the late 2010s. And in between this, you have Neo4j, which is started in 2007. It's a transaction processing system at heart for a graph database. So it's also really focused at commercial applications. You know, you want to store real-time transactions from your users, from your clients. in your database. So you want obviously all of the nice things that you get from a modern day database, such as indexes, transactions, and actually you also get a sort of online analytics processing side to Neo4j. So you can run those huge computational problems like find me the most optimal route between every two node in the entire graph. It also lends itself well to that because I think it has multiple modes to operate this on. But it basically popularized this idea around the labeled property graph. So a graph alone, just the data about the relationship, which RDFs are very, very much oriented around, is not really enough to use in meaningful ways. So what you need is a lot more labels or a lot more properties for the nodes and also the relationships themselves, because often just modeling, say, a social network simply as A is friends with B is nice in a theoretical, or not even a theoretical, but taking, let's say, real world data to test your theoretical or test your theories against or test your algorithms against is nice. But usually relationships are more complex or more, let's say more rich than that typical naive assumption that this is all the data that we could possibly want to work with. So maybe A is friends with B, but actually has a strength or a weight on their relationship, or the relationship itself contains a lot more details about that relationship in your social network. So maybe they like a lot of their posts. Maybe they are talking to them a lot in the direct messaging app. All these things, you know, you want a way in to store richer data about your relationships and also about your nodes themselves. So that's where Neo4j really came into popularity. It's built on using Cypher, which is the basically the query language for Neo4j. It's at this point where I want to like point out, and this is where I want to bring in Gracken, or actually what it's called, TypeDB. Is this split between an ontology language or an OWL, and therefore an ontology database or a knowledge database, whatever you call it, and the difference between a graph database. And maybe Reagan, you can like talk a little bit about that distinction and about what actually TypeDB does, how it differs maybe a little bit from Neo4j. But yeah, that was a bit of a history lesson. And I'm interested to see where this goes.
One thing that you mentioned there was how you have this sort of subject verb object relationship, and how there was sort of a movement towards making the web more comprehensible for machines. Mm-hmm. And that actually reminds me of the conversation we had on logic programming, where should we be making the web more comprehensible to computers, or mm-hmm. making computers better at reading the patterns of human speech?
Yeah.
And that links up really nicely to logic programming, or what we mm-hmm. might call inference in general. So another application of graph theory is building these knowledge graphs. So your facts and the way that they connect to one another can be modeled with graph theory as well. And many Prolog implementations or Datalog implementations themselves use graphs internally to like traverse your list of facts.
Sure. Yeah.
So almost in a sort of finite state automata way, you have a machine that's traversing the known facts, and they're trying to end up in a resultant state. So can you show that this person is a friend, like two friends removed from this other person? Can we recommend this person mm-hmm. as a connection mm-hmm. in their social media app? And that's perhaps where TypeDB comes in, where TypeDB is oriented as this sort of inference engine. It's not so much trying to directly simulate a graph so much as it's trying to give you tools to control inference about these different entities.
Yeah.
So it's not strictly modeling these graphs as graphs, but they're giving you like a front end, a logical front end that may or may not be in graph mm-hmm. graph concepts, mm-hmm. But is really more sort of data logic programming. Like you said, an ontology, you're building sort of this semantic layer that you can then query afterwards. Would you be able to contrast that?
That's an interesting contrast there, that I guess some at the very simplistic level, maybe graph databases use graphs because at a theoretic level, they are advantageous, and ontologies, they use it because ontologies without graphs are quite hard to represent. So they use it as a means to an end. Because one thing I mentioned is that graphs are great for visualization. Like if you Google graph and you go into the image view, then you're going to get a bunch of nice visuals on what a graph looks like. That's very hard to do for other problems. If you're a visual person, if you're a visual learner, actually trying to find visual representations of problems can be really tricky, especially computational problems. The fact that you can reduce a lot of problems in what's known as a gadget in computer science, to be able to reduce one problem to another class of problems. So from, let's say, how do you reduce the three satisfiability problem? You can reduce that to a three-way graph coloring algorithm. And maybe if you see that and you see the three-way graph coloring, that may make a lot more sense than if you were to try and look at a three-sat problem from a standard imperative approach, or imperative style, or pseudocode style. That's a really neat thing about graphs. So going back to that, yeah, I guess using it as a means to an end, or as an actual internal, an internal representation of the data, is anyway a bit of a blurry line, because as we mentioned, graphs are like this visualization. Then you have the matrices, which is sort of, you know, how you would represent it in mathematical form, or let's say in ones and zeros in binary form. That's a very simplistic graph, of course. It already becomes a bit of a blurry line as to how you classify a problem as a matrix and a, let's say, a linear algebra problem and a graph algorithm or a graph problem. And how do you distinguish the two?
You mentioned there the problem of graph coloring, which I think is particularly apt. Like when you read about graph theory, or you try to sort of traverse the rabbit hole of graph theory, you start to get the sense that maybe half of the problems in graph theory are graph coloring. And would you be able to explain what graph coloring is and sort of what the motive is for what graph coloring achieves?
Yeah, sure. So graph coloring is really simple. It's essentially a satisfiability test. So it's a property of a graph. Whether or not you can color a graph with n number of colors such that no two nodes that are adjacent to one another have the same color. So you really want that mosaic, or not mosaic, but you really want that completely random looking art. That's what it would look like really a graph with all sorts of random colors and no structure, because you don't want any two nodes that are adjacent to one another to have the same color. So I said n because I wanted to leave it like parameterized for now. The parameter is, can you color this graph with three colors such that it satisfies the graph coloring property? And yes or no, like can you use three colors? So color node A in yellow, color node B in blue, and then color node C in green. Those are your colors. You've already used that namespace now. So you need to use the same three colors to color all the other nodes in a way such that you get to a point where none of the two nodes that are adjacent in the whole graph have the same color. And if that's not true, then yeah, you can try four, you can try five, you can try six. It's essentially, I guess, really abstractly, you're taking a namespace, you know, a set of properties, and you're then taking a graph and you're seeing whether or not you can apply those properties in such a way that no two relationships share the same property. So that's useful for like resource planning or scheduling, because you want to use you want to be able to come up with a schedule for a problem. So really just like, you know, okay, you're planning like literally time and seeing whether three people can, let's say, find a meeting next week, dependent on whether their meetings overlap, whether there's a free spot for everyone. You can basically represent as a graph coloring algorithm. So that's one very, I think, common application of graph coloring. Have you got any more? Because now I'm trying to scratch my head thinking of some useful ones.
So one interesting one I came across is that you can approach the problem of Sudoku as a graph coloring problem. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine the numbers 1 to 9, those can just be, you can choose arbitrary colors for those. Yeah. Essentially you've got 9 distinct colors, and you have this grid and you're trying to solve a very specific constraint on these colors.
Exactly. Yeah, it's constraint problem driven problems, right?
So you can, if you take a unsolved Sudoku and you assign colors to the numbers that are already there, the solution to that Sudoku just falls out of graph coloring. So you can run the existing graph coloring algorithms and suddenly you have a solution for Sudoku. Mm-hmm. And there are unexpected connections to graph coloring that at least when I look at them, it's surprising that this one algorithm has so many distinct applications in different fields. But mm-hmm. I guess it's what you were saying, that it's the abstract idea of resource allocation. It's how do mm-hmm. we partition things? What can be matched with what? Scheduling, sort of timetabling, those kind of problems, constraint propagation, those tend to be very conducive to graphs mm-hmm. and graph coloring algorithms.
Yeah, indeed. And as I mentioned before, like this idea of a gadget in computational theory is like reducing the reducibility of problem A to problem B and the rules to get from A to B. And graphs just lend themselves so well to being reduced to and reducing to other problem sets, such that if it's a useful means of representation, especially for the, if you're constructing a problem and you're getting nowhere, you've got a problem and you're trying to solve it and you're getting nowhere, then sometimes reducing it to a graph can actually help you solve the problem, because you can see all the interconnections at the same time and you're not needing to infer them from just looking at a piece of pseudocode or like the data representation of whatever you feed into your pseudocode. That's probably a better way of saying things. And that can be just a very useful tool to have. Mm. I wonder, is the Philosopher's Dinner, is this also represented as a, can be represented as a graph coloring algorithm?
I think it can be, because you're trying to, I'm actually not sure, because that has fundamentally, that's like time is an order related, so maybe it's an iterative graph coloring problem. You mentioned earlier that your master's was on the sort of partitioning of these graphs, and this might just be a shot in the dark, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I read that that partitioning can be informed by the eigenvectors and the eigenvalues of the adjacency matrix. Did that factor into your master's thesis?
No, I didn't actually, but I guess I could either do this by thinking out loud, or maybe I'll defer the problem back to you and say, do you have some insight there?
So eigenvectors and eigenvalues are measures of kind of the entropy of vectors within a matrix. So if you can think about what's the sort of internal entropy of this group of nodes, and what eigenvectors can give you is like a convenient way to reproject a graph so that it looks nicer, so that there's not so many conflicts. Mm-hmm. So what often happens is that a graph might not have a good looking projection in two dimensions. So if you can imagine the platonic solid of a dodecahedron, like a football shape.
You lost me. Continue.
If you can think about sort of a, like a football shape or even a cube. There's certain shapes that if you have this in three dimensions and you're putting vertices where, at the edges, where you're connecting all of these wires, maybe when you're in school, you built like these homemade projects and you're like making these little mathematical shapes. There wouldn't be necessarily a convenient way to project that onto a flat page, but the most appropriate visualization for that graph might actually be in higher dimensions. And especially when you're talking about attaching all of these different attributes to a graph, there might not be easy ways to present them in two dimensions. Colors are like a convenient way to introduce a new dimension to anything. So like you can have three dimensions and you can add a color, and that's generally useful for graphing things like in general, like you can, you have access to an extra dimension, but after that you sort of run out of ways to make things distinct. Like,
But it sounds an awful lot like geometric topology, right? Like if you're trying to model things in a three-dimensional space using graphs, then I guess it's probably, again, hard to distinguish what do you classify this problem as, a topological problem or as a graph theory problem. But at the end of the day, like, it probably needs to go from geometric topology to a graph problem to machine readable code if you actually want to try and automate or try and run some computation over it, right? But yeah, interesting you mentioned about information theory, that actually the one of the community famous community detection algorithms, so actually identifying communities of nodes within a graph, is based upon Shannon entropy. So this is called the Louvain method, or the Louvain community detection algorithm. And it's essentially built upon this optimization function, which is information entropy. And you need to basically you allocate communities, and then you see what is the information loss, or sorry, what is how compressible, let's say, is the community in a bunch of communities. And that's like saying, okay, well, I guess it's a little bit similar to what you're talking about with the eigenvectors. But I wonder, I wonder if I was just at that point too obtuse to think of that as a possible solution, but it's super cool.
On a sort of more philosophical question, or maybe a sort of pragmatic root of history question, it seems like with all of these different solutions, there's very compelling technologies to model graphs on a commercial level. Mm-hmm. In my previous employment in logistics, there was also like a deployment of graph of a managed graph for route planning and for, you know, intra warehouse movements, but that seemed to be sort of an exception rather than the norm. Do you have any intuitions why graph theory hasn't taken off? Can you think of any constraints that might prevent it from overtaking maybe more traditional data storage methods?
So one place where I can see it be useful is in recommendation systems or recommender systems, because you have, let's say, in a media platform or a, let's say, Netflix, for example, you have a bunch of titles. So you have a bunch of movies or TV shows, and then you have a bunch of users and how they rated that TV show. And what you need to do is basically infer what a user who hasn't seen that TV show will think of that TV show. So you basically need to calculate or guess what their score would be for that TV show, and then you can sort them by, you know, how popular they would be, and then you can recommend those titles to the user first. And that all depends on how users who rate TV shows similar to them, what score they give them those TV shows, and whether there's a high degree of correlation between all those users. And then you basically need to match users together. You find a user who's rated every title in Netflix, so then you match together someone who's rated a subset of those titles but give a very similar score, and then you have a great correlation for how you should recommend the next title to the user who hasn't seen every title. That's obviously represented in a matrix, right? So you have users and titles, and you have their rating. You can put it in an Excel spreadsheet. This is useful, of course, because it's sparse. So often most users haven't seen every title. You would hope so, at least, like, especially in a platform like YouTube. You know, you have a huge disproportionate amount of content compared to the number of users. So it's very nice to represent this as a graph or a natural graph. So there I can definitely see it being useful to then, you know, serialize, store this matrix in graph form in a graph database, and then infer from that relationships and powerful, potentially even real-time analysis. Not sure really how feasible that would be to infer like this in real time. So say if you another user just viewed a title and then rated the title very positively, how feasible that would be to recalculate for every other user who is a sort of similar to that user, and then give them an updated view on recommendations. My guess is that most of this is done offline and in a OLAP kind of approach, so like the online analytics processing approach. So my girlfriend is actually doing a PhD in pharmaceutical science, and she cares a lot about protein interactions to prove whether or not, basically, whether or not cancer treatment is going to be useful for a patient or not before you even give them the cancer treatment, and looking at protein interactions. I guess this is another useful way to apply graphs, is to see, okay, well, protein A interacts with protein B in a certain way. It only takes so many examples before you start seeing literally the world in graphs. So you start seeing graphs everywhere, and I think that's the cool thing. Even if you're coming from a geometry angle, you start to see geometry as well in graph form, in three-dimensional graphs. Because, you know, point A and point B in geometry, often there's useful information about that relationship in the real world, maybe not in a mathematical laboratory, but in the real world, there's something useful about the that angle or that that line that goes from A to B that's different from that other line. Maybe this then segues on a bit to a more complex theoretical topic around hypergraphs, because this is another level of abstraction on top of graph theory. Well, it's a generalization of graph theory. Maybe you can talk a bit about hypergraphs, because they're also a really cool thing to chew on.
Yes, and also just to comment on your girlfriend's work, just in researching for this episode, I came across there's a whole classification of what they call SNP problems, which stands for single nucleotide polymorphisms. So in like DNA strands or in the assembly of proteins, you have polymorphisms similar to the way that you have language polymorphism.
Really?
Which I find extremely interesting in that there's multiple variants of these enzymes, or I'm not a biologist, I'm going to get all of this wrong.
Don't worry, my girlfriend's not sort of stood over my shoulder making sure we get everything right, so we can talk relatively general.
I'm very glad. But yes, so in assembling a protein, there's multiple components that can be exchanged, and they'll both they'll all be accepted, but they all have slightly different effects, and there's a whole classification of biological programs called SNP assembly problems.
Wow.
And they're like, it really struck me how techy it is that there's this sort of like very low level biological polymorphism happening, which is very surprising.
Well, yeah, that's super cool. But I guess because it comes from mathematical polymorphism, right? Hence where the programming language, generics, essentially different types of generics, of course, it's not just one, but like that's where generics come from different types of polymorphism. Oh, that's super cool. It is like the programming of the human genome in a sense, kind of theme, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and that's super and cool.
On the topic of hypergraphs that you mentioned, one other application in STEM, we have mentioned Stephen Wolfram before, just in passing. He's a very interesting character, but at the moment his main initiative is to sort of derive the fundamental theories of the universe from a hypergraph that's generated through finite state automata. So there is something very like fundamentally spatial or like fundamentally predictive of graphs. I should probably say that hypergraphs are graphs that have one to many, or that the edges can involve more than two nodes. So instead of saying person A is related to person B in some way, you say that this group of people are related in some fashion. So in the social network, that might be that they have a WhatsApp group together. The definitions the definitions required for classical graph theory algorithms need to be migrated a bit. Since making the assumption that an edge only has two nodes is useful for certain things like calculating where cycles are or where these clusters are, but fundamentally you can perform the same types of computation on hypergraphs, and you can derive some interesting results from that. Among them being database partitioning. So if you're trying to look at where certain blocks of memory should be allocated, knowing that sort of this index is used as with these fields, or if you're storing things column-wise, that using hypergraphs can inform how the layout on disk actually looks.
Right. Yeah. That's the things with these data processing systems, right? Is that in theory, if they could all run on just memory, then they would perform exceedingly well. But usually you have to deal with the limitations of the fact that you need to store a lot of data, therefore you need to store probably a lot of it on disk. And then you need to really think about how you partition, also then how you store those partitions, and also index wise, like you mentioned, how are you creating the index? Is it a B-tree or is it like an LSM, which is a log structured merge tree? Those two lend themselves differently to read versus write performance. There's so many things that come into this equation. Typically one thing that's known for sure is that you're going to run this database partially on disk, partially in memory. So like partitioning challenges, that's super cool that you can apply like hypergraph theory to to partitioning, especially, yeah, especially in the transaction processing world. So the transaction processing database world, that's a trickier problem as well, of course, because you have to constantly think about rebalancing partitions when more data is fed into your system. In the analytics world, it's still tricky, don't get me wrong, because you're going to be a lot more read intensive. Therefore, your read performance and knowing where data is stored on which partition, that can obviously impact massively the read performance for an analytics processing system. But you don't have to worry too much about the write side, because you're not constantly writing new data into the analytics platform, unless you do give yourself that challenge to give yourself real-time analytics as well. That's going to be also a problem. I'm probably oversimplifying things there. But yeah, from a hypergraph perspective, so one thing I want to comment is that Neo4j cannot model hypergraphs in the Cypher language. That's just not possible. It's one of the limitations that I thought was, if there is no way to really do this effectively, and the solution is basically to create a new graph that represents the nodes in the hypergraph and then links between the nodes. Okay, so you have then the groups of nodes are just now a new node. But then as soon as you want to insert a new person to that WhatsApp group, or you want to redefine your hypergraph relationships between the nodes, then it becomes really expensive, because essentially what you're doing then is just changing the schema in real time for every person that you're, or every new node that you're adding to your graph. So yeah, like, I wonder if they will support hypergraphs in the future. Probably they're struggling maybe somewhat anyway with the adoption of just standard graph applications. The hypergraphs are like being one level of generalization above that is going to be not a worthwhile problem for them to solve in the short run. So maybe taking one step back, one problem that has eluded me for quite a while is, how do you classify a database versus a data processing system? And, well, what do I mean by how can you distinguish them? Well, what are the things that fundamentally make a database? And is it not the lack of those properties that makes a data processing system? So that's still a bit abstract. Let me talk maybe a bit more about, is Neo4j a database, or is it a graph data processing system? Because you can't store graphs in the form that we know them in visual form on disk. It's just not feasible. There you'd be storing matrices, probably as your closest representation in mathematics form, which is obviously going to be very inefficient. What actually makes that, what Neo4j a database? Is it the query language? Is it the fact that it has like ACID properties, that it has indexes, that it does replication, that it has relational constraints? Like, are these what makes a database? Because then you could argue, well, are NoSQL databases then databases? And then data processing systems, on the other hand, you know, you have like, for example, Kafka is an event processing system, and yet it has ACID properties. Like, you can actually create a database from Kafka. Itself is not a database because it doesn't really have a structured query language for inserting. It doesn't have a deleting and updating as the DML, so the data modification language. And the data querying language is also different to what you're used to in relational databases. But Martin Kleppmann has put it before that, you know, Kafka gives you the building blocks to make your database from. So I wondered, what in your mind gives you the distinction between the two? So, you know, your Neo4j versus your GraphX.
I would say probably an imperfect but useful heuristic would be, is the data living here? So you have a lot of these stream processing systems like Hadoop and BigQuery, mm-hmm. and they're managing data, but is that the where the single source of truth lies? And I mm-hmm. think that's sort of, that would be my deciding factor, is this where, if everything else stops, is this where data lives? Mm-hmm. And so I would argue that mm-hmm. you know, NoSQL databases like Mongo and all of these solutions, they are databases. It is surprising how resistant or persistent SQL databases are. They mm-hmm. seem very hesitant to be replaced, and even though that we have all of these solutions now, it seems like often the best choice is just to go with a Postgres SQL database.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that it just depends.
Is that like the yardstick then, do you think? Like the relational database management systems, are they like the definition of a database?
Personally, I believe that that many database management systems are bloated. They mm-hmm. have a bit too much built into them. I think the philosophy of SQL Lite,
mm-hmm.
I find that quite an attractive idea, where you have a sophisticated way with interacting with data, but it exists as a flat file in your
mm-hmm.
directory. Mm-hmm. When you're working with SQL databases, it's often very opaque how mm-hmm. that is translated on disk and how you actually migrate those.
Mm-hmm.
At least that has been my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any ideas of what makes a database in your opinion?
So yeah, I guess I'm still asking around to get an idea. I don't think this debate will ever be answered, and at least in my mind at the moment, this is the reason why. What we classified as a database 30 years ago is very, very different from what we classify a database as now, but nonetheless, we call them the same thing. So, you know, back in the 1970s, replication, distributed, so the distributed systems aspects like replication, you know, multi-leader or single leader, no leader topologies weren't really things that they were solving. Durability, resilience, all these properties that we now say, okay, well, you know, our modern day SQL databases have these things, and also a lot of modern day NoSQL databases have these things, also transactions, and you know, we've added to the list of things that which a database are or maybe can optionally be, but they still need a fundamental subset of those options to make them a database, because otherwise you could just take away them all and you could say, well, this nothing is a database, which you know the base case wouldn't work. So yeah, I don't know. There's a subset of those things that you need to, I guess they need to be like, this is then classified as a database. Is it ACID? I don't know, because that's a database where you need transactions, for example, ACID transactions. But actually, maybe you don't care about those things in other ways in which you use databases. So like the analytics side of the equation, you know, OLAP systems don't really need transactions. They may need transactions for updating the analytics store, or you know, doing your final data warehouse build, for example, because you want to make sure that that's in a consistent state, that is isolated and it's durable, and it's also an atomic operation, because you don't want half of your analytics database to be replaced whilst the other is still, you know, coming online. So I guess ACID isn't one of those things. So then it just, I don't know, I keep going back to, what are the fundamental set of properties of a database, where you distinguish between a data processing system and a database itself. So when I say data processing, I think more like Kafka, Spark, Hadoop, these languages and frameworks. And also, you know, Spark is also a distributed data set implementation, which also offers durability and all of the properties that you would like from a database. Those are what I think of as being data processing systems. So then you have like GraphX, which is the extension to Spark for graph processing. How does that fundamentally differ from a database like Neo4j? Well, one of the ways is definitely like the query language. So there is no query language for GraphX. It's a Java API or a Scala API. And you basically write your analytics queries in a like vertex oriented fashion, so in a functional fashion, which you can then distribute over a number of nodes to run a computation over, whereas the database like Neo4j, you define it as a single declarative query. It's not purely functional in the sense that it's you're declaring, you know, what are the parameters of the data that I want to filter, join, and basically find. So therefore, it's a different perspective. But I don't know whether that is then what defines the difference between a database and a data processing system, at least in the graph region. I thought it's an interesting problem to how to classify these things. I guess the takeaway is that it's all software and it's all running somewhere and it all has certain non-functional properties around it. They're going to differ. Maybe we should just throw away this kind of arcane argument over, is it a database? Is it not? Is it, you know, is it SQL? Is it not SQL? And just admit that even every SQL database that's created has subtle differences between one another. So for example, MySQL and Postgres, they differ very much in their disk layout and their optimization techniques. The query language is the same, but the query language is not what defines a database in this regard. We just classify these databases use this query language that's common to them all, but everything else is different. Therefore, they're all different within one another. Otherwise, there'd only be one SQL database.
I guess the reductionist argument would be that ultimately you just have data, you've got memory, you've got CPU, and programs are data, and you just happen to have a program that converts data from one format to another. And whether it resides mostly on disk or in memory or in mm-hmm. caches or in registers in the CPU, that's sort yeah. of it's a continuous gradient between those. And there'll be applications and there'll be data solutions at every level of those. You have memcached for mm-hmm. the very low level, and you've got, you know, stratification at every level between mm-hmm. you know, caches, registers, and mm-hmm. disk.
Exactly. Like that's the if I was going to make ever like one quote modification, the quote, there's only two hard problems in computer science, naming and caching validation, I would change it to cache locality, because that's the real hard part, right? Like how do you locate your data as close to the CPU as possible to make the next operation optimistically the most efficient? That's such a tricky problem, but indeed they all try and do these things in the best way for their use cases. And I guess taking one level back, one step out of the rabbit hole, like maybe the fact that Neo4j hasn't taken off hugely is that they're still defining the use cases to make a solid attack on the market, let's say. So a solid attack on, this is the way to do fraud detection. This is the way to do protein sequencing. This is the way to do recommender systems, because it isn't, because all those things have alternatives and they work pretty well. So you need to think about, yeah, what other advantages do you get with a graph database that should make it enticing for the end consumer?
That's a very good point. And we'll be looking at a whole bunch of different data solutions going forward as part of this series. And I think this, like you said, this conversation about what is a database, what is a data processing solution, I think that's going to be ongoing, and we're only going to see new solutions and new products in straddling those two different concepts. And thanks for chatting about graph theory today, Phil. It's been extremely enlightening, and I've learned things, and hopefully I didn't come across as too incompetent.
Definitely not. Thanks, Reagan. I'm definitely going to go straight away after this and clue up on eigenvectors and information theory for geometric topologies. That's super cool. I need to go back to school on this one. So thanks very much.
Cool. Till next time.
Till next time. Bye-bye.
Nice.
I almost quit the Zoom meeting then, because it's such a common thing for me to say, bye, okay, quit.
That built-in, that deep-seated brain program.